Our third speaker is Shalini Khan, who is a doctoral candidate at Queen's University. Her dissertation title is the following: Infectious Entanglements, Literary and Medical Representations of Disease in the Postcolonial Caribbean. Her areas of interest include postcolonial literatures and theory, the history of medicine, medical and scientific discourses in Caribbean literatures in English, and early medical texts. Shalini, please.
Thank you. This paper is taken from a larger work, and the full title is entitled Mythopoiesis and the Fevered Body in Harold Ledoux's No Pain Like This Body. And I continue some of the conversations that we've been having on the Ramayana. And I think, as Atri pointed out yesterday, in addition to the Ramayana, there are other references to sacred texts in Ledoux's novel, but I'm going to be focusing specifically on the Ramayana in this presentation. In this paper, I examine No Pain Like This Body from the point of view of anti-myth, and end with a few short comments about the novel, what the novel contributes to Caribbean literature. Working against the grain of a prior narrative, anti-myth in effect creates new, complex mythic structures that depend on a dynamic tension between the old narrative and the new. Of central importance to Ledoux's anti-myth is Rama, the young child who develops a fever and later dies, and the namesake of the Ramayana's epic hero. By working against the grain of the Ramayana, Ledoux attempts to articulate an early Indo-Caribbean identity based on a critique of aspects of the Ramayana that he identifies in relation to particular values and ideals. Now, I'll begin with a short summary. No Pain Like This Body focuses on a family of rice planters, Ma, Pa, and four children, Balraj, Sunari, and twins Rama and Pandi. Set in a rural district of Carib Island, also recognizable as Trinidad, the events of the novel unfold in August 1905, during the rainy rice planting season. At the beginning of the novel, the drunken father beats his wife and eldest son, Balraj. Mother and son flee the home, followed by the twins and Sunari. Caught in a thunderstorm, they are all soaked and Rama becomes sick. Ma's parents, Nani and Nana, try unsuccessfully to heal the child with traditional folk remedies and prayers. Later, both Rama and Balraj are stung by scorpions and, after much difficulty on account of the storm, are taken to the colonial hospital where Rama dies. The rest of the narrative focuses on the wake and the stories and behavior of the drunken villagers and on Pa's continued abuse of the family. The novel ends with Ma going mad. In the Ramayana, Lord Rama, exiled prince and later king of Ayodhya, is an incarnation of Lord Vishnu. Widely regarded as the ideal Hindu, Rama vanquishes the Raksha king Ravan and liberates all beings from Ravan's tyranny. Returning to Ayodhya at the end of his exile, Rama is welcomed and honored by his people. In the mythic universe of the Ramayana, perfect virtue is rewarded, good overcomes evil, and light triumphs over darkness. Ledoux's No Pain Like This Body invokes aspects of the Ramayana and other sacred Hindu texts brought by the indentured laborers from India to the Caribbean, but troubles the Ramayana's quintessential sense of divine order. This is partly accomplished through Ledoux's anti-myth of Carib Island, in which strains of the old world narratives become visible for brief, fleeting moments, after which they are supplanted by more dominant images of chaos, darkness, and violence. In this world, Ledoux explodes simple binaries of good and evil, of order and balance in the universe, and toys with morally laden images of light and darkness, such as are found in the Ramayana. These themes are most clearly conveyed through the anti-parallel narrative between Lord Rama and his young New World namesake, and more particularly through the events leading to the child's sickness and subsequent death. New World Rama is a boy of 8. Both Ramas are banished from the family home, but while the epic hero is unwillingly banished by a loving father, the child flees his home fearful of Pa. Both Ramas undergo trials in their period of exile. The prince, demonstrating his skill in war and his favor among gods, successfully vanquishes demons and other evildoers, and at the same time proves his worthiness as a warrior and king. The child Rama is also tried in exile. His adversaries, however, are invoked as wind, rain, and even scorpions, and a father who initiates the child's self-inflicted exile. Unlike his epic namesake, however, the child is not victorious. He becomes ill and later dies at hospital. Indeed, while Lord Rama saves others using medicinal herbs and prayers, similar treatments do not save the child. In Carib Island, there is an incongruence between the sacred mythology that informs cultural habits and everyday reality. Here, herbs do not heal, and prayers are not answered. And instead of the bright celestial carriage that brings Lord Rama home, the child arrives on a donkey cart, wrapped in burial cloths, and cut from neck to belly. Both Ramas arrive just before dawn, but while the new day heralds the start of Ayodhya's golden age, the child's death brings further misery and tragedy to his mother and siblings. Ledu's anti-myth takes shape partly through his invocation of pseudo-cosmic adversaries, such as wind and rain, against whom the child Rama has no recourse. Personifying the wind and rain as sentient entities, the narrator suggests that these forces willfully seek out and harm the mother and her vulnerable children. With Rama, this is especially evident. The narrator tells us, quote, "The rain didn't care about Tola," end quote, that it was, quote, "pounding the earth," that raindrops touched the children's skins as needles, and, quote, "that the wind was blowing with such force and temper just to cause trouble and hate," end quote. The wind and rain pound, they touch, they cause strife, suggesting deliberate action. Examples such as these, laden with personification, are frequent in the first half of the novel up to when we last see Rama alive, and contribute to the notion that the wind and rain intend to cause suffering. Indeed, the wind and rain seem to find Rama everywhere, even where, when he is placed inside the closed, coffin-like rice box in an effort to keep him dry. Unlike the Ramayana's grand battle between the forces of good and evil, in no pain like this body, the players are less consequential and the struggle more prosaic. By presenting pseudo-cosmic adversaries such as wind and rain, Ledu troubles the Ramayana's grand narrative of the battle between good and evil and its clear-cut moral paradigm, and provides another less idealistic, though more complex reading of adversity that points to perpetual suffering and injustice that is best invoked in what is perhaps the most nihilistic moment in the text, when we last see Rama alive. Burning with fever, Rama is perched on Nana's back as the old man attempts to cross the Tola River to get to the colonial hospital. Ma, Sunari, Pandey, and Nani watch the crossing. Quote, "Then the time grew long, long like a rope, and tied them like a rope too. Their bodies formed one great beast reaching up to the sky. And the clouds opened, and out of the middle came water, water that washed away the earth into the mouth of the darkness. And the winds became hot and carried death into all the corners. Then the rope caught fire, and the great beast danced to the tune of death between darkness and the void. The beast danced even though it knew it was going to die. It danced and danced till the void and the darkness strangled the beast." End quote. The Tola River is here invoked as a Kalapani, the crossing of which brings even more suffering after Rama dies at hospital. Of particular importance in this episode, however, is the invocation of other pseudo-sentient entities such as darkness, time, and wind. Metaphorized as a beast who is ready to swallow the earth, the darkness is aligned with death. Indeed, the puny humans are besieged by a horde of pseudo-cosmic adversaries such as clouds, wind, and time, the combined presence of which contribute to a sense of foreboding that the human congregation will be overwhelmed. Of particular significance is the narrator's invocation of the rope of time as a cosmic apparition that binds the humans together, connecting the humans with the darkness and the void, and working in tandem with the wind and the rain to batter the children and their mother and imprison them in a hellish world of suffering. Each moment in this extract is instinctive and ritualistically significant. The transformation of the humans into the beast, tethered by the long rope of time, for example, is for the purpose of sacrifice. In this image, any hopeful illusions are dispelled, for the beast totters precariously close to the darkness and the void. The dance of death is the dance of life in this place, an eerie recognition that one must go on, though each forward step takes us closer to the gaping mouth of the darkness that lies in wait, silently and inevitably. the transformation of the humans into the beast, the terrible dance, the struggle between the darkness and the beast, together creates a cosmic-type narrative whose implications stretch far beyond the fate of the sick child. The story is mythical. Time is tyrannical. The human being is assailed. Death and destruction are inevitable, not just for Rama and his family, but for all. This is the moral of Ledu's cosmic allegory. Here there is no beneficent light, as in the Ramayana, to dispel the darkness. Only the destructive fire that consumes the long rope of time and those humans bound in its tyranny remain. In the narrative, Rama's fevered body, literally his body heated to excess, connects with this image of the destructive fire. In the Ramayana, the fever of existence refers to earthly suffering and points to the idea that life is burdensome. When the young Lord Rama is consecrated and purified by holy water, however, he is taught the science of Bala and Atibala, a collection of sacred formulas so that neither fatigue, fever, nor age will then affect him. Such immunity will come because Rama is deemed worthy of such tribute and because he is chosen by Brahma to destroy Ravan, the Ramayana's most fearsome and powerful manifestation of evil. Indeed, sickness in the Ramayana, while referring to literal biological phenomenon, acquires metaphysical intonations as spiritual sickness, characteristic of the not-as-yet-perfected man still enveloped in cycles of birth and death. Unlike Lord Rama, luminous human incarnation of Vishnu, the child burns with fever. His illness is associated with a destructive heat, like the fire that burns the rope of time, and not with beneficent light. Here there are no sacred formulae to render him immune. Rama's fevered body is both a metaphor for and manifestation of material suffering that draws us back to the world of Carib Island, where poverty and domestic abuse are connected to suffering, illness, and death. In this world, children flee from an abusive father. They go hungry because Pa spends his time and money drinking rum, and their home is ramshackle and cannot keep them warm and dry. While the Ramayana invokes fever as earthly suffering, as a reminder that heavenly bliss awaits the faithful sufferer, no pain like this body does not gesture beyond the earthly realm. The narrative never palliates or ennobles earthly suffering in any way. Instead, the narrative focuses on the spiral of suffering which continues after Rama's death and which is most poignant in Ledu's presentation of madness. Ma's madness is Ledu's final, definitive, anti-mythic statement and the means by which he reiterates that there is no escape from the darkness. The novel ends with Nana, Nani, and the children about to enter the Tola forest to search for Ma, now mad with grief, after Rama's death. In the context of Ladu's engagement with myth and anti-myth, Ma's madness indicates her severance from the mythic universe in which she was previously immersed, that is, the world of conservative Hindu values apotheosized in the Ramayana. In this mythic world, perseverance, obedience, and tolerance of suffering are qualities associated with the ideal Hindu wife, of which Sita is the prototype. Indeed, Ma's refusal to leave her abusive husband and her insistence that, quote, by the grace of God, these same charans going to come man and woman in this same tola, end quote, may be read in light of a mythological narrative that values patience and tolerance suffering and which depends in part on the individual's belief in a benevolent God and in divine order. Lost to the darkness, however, Rama shatters her faith in such a narrative. Indeed, the incongruity between myth and reality forces Ma to confront what cultural anthropologist Joseph Campbell calls a terrible truth, that innocence and goodness do not always prevail and that the world is chaotic and violent. Her madness is evidence of an abrupt and violent transformation from obedient Hindu wife to a broken woman thrust from the community with their shared history and cultural texts, what Campbell calls the womb of mythology. In No Pain Like This Body, Ledu's anti-myth grates against the myth of the Ramayana with an excoriating effect that renders visible the gaps within each narrative. The text invites us to read with these spaces in mind. Indeed, in No Pain, meaning itself is unstable in between the ever-shifting tiles of a slippery narrative in which wind and rain blur into the violence of an abusive father and where the Ramayana cannot hold its shape when tested against the everyday reality of Ma and the children. On the day of the funeral, the pundit, quote, pulling out his Ramayana, prepares to say some prayers for Rama, end quote. In this act, the old epic and the new grate against each other with ironic effect. Indeed, the Ramayana celebrating triumph and order is inappropriate at the last rites for the deceased child, whose life and death explode the epic's quintessential sense of order and goodness. In one of the narrative's most troubling ironies, the dead child is dressed in new clothes, when in life he sometimes went naked because there was nothing to wear. This incongruence between Rama's life and his treatment in death point to the larger incongruence of a religious culture that is out of sync with the everyday reality of the people. Yet another grating irony involves the villagers' participation in sacred rituals, juxtaposed with their bawdy and raucous behavior at the wake. That the villagers choose to retain the sacred texts as figureheads of a professed though unlived spiritual ethic is evidence of a hollow spirituality that sometimes cloaks a more insidious, self-interested, and uncritical individualism that is demonstrated in their almost hedonistic attachment to rum drinking, sexual scandal, and village gossip, often at the expense of the others. It is some of these villagers, we learn, who abuse Ma at the wake and literally force rum down her throat, with the effect that Pa is able to create a new believable story that it is his wife who is drunk and who abuses her family, and that it is he who tried to pull the family together. Ma's madness means that she cannot defend herself from this injustice, and the implication is that it is this story that will remain. No Pain critiques a posture of engagement of those like Ma who uncritically accept the traditionally extolled values of the sacred texts, and of others like the villagers whose values are incongruent with the rituals they perform. The novel suggests that it is such blind faith as in the case of Ma, or hollow spirituality in the case of the villagers, which allows systems of abuse to continue. This theme is reiterated and intensified in Ladu's second novel, Yesterday's, set approximately 50 years later. Indeed, No Pain suggests that the early Indo-Caribbean communities were complicit in acts of injustice and neglect against their own people, demonstrated in the conditions leading to Rama's illness and death, and in Ma's madness. By relegating European colonialism to the background, the narrative focuses instead on the entanglement of debilitating cultural practices with the difficulties of poverty in one Indo-Caribbean community at the turn of the 20th century, and opens a space for more complex and critical engagement with issues of Indo-Caribbean subjectivity that takes into account both material and psychological effects of indentureship from within the community itself. Like Walcott, Ladu suggests that the Caribbean individual, in this case the Indo-Caribbean, should not remain exclusively focused on the culture and narratives of the prior homeland, a concept that is particularly meaningful in light of the Indo-Caribbean community's historically strong identification with Mother India. Such ethnic and nationalist identification influenced the shape of Indo-Caribbean culture, which remained relatively close to ethnic outsiders for the first half of the 20th century. While Ledu does not engage deeply with non-Indian ethnic elements, aspects of a slowly creolizing Indian culture are already evident in the narrative, in African folkloric elements such as jumbies, and in the villagers' stories involving other ethnic characters. These brief insertions are evidence of small cracks in the bubble-like Indo-Caribbean community, and point to the latter's inability to retain an ethnic-based cultural purity in the midst of a multi-ethnic society. In this context, No Pain is an important contribution to Caribbean literatures in general, and Caribbean mythopoetic literature and art in particular, typically associated with the works of Wilson Harris and Leroy Clark. Indeed, Ledu's anti-mythic engagement with Hindu/Indian texts potentially reconceptualizes the shape of Caribbean mythopoetics, in particular its association with what Caribbean philosopher Page Henry identifies as Afro-Caribbean philosophy, and opens a space for the study of other cultural forms within the genre of Caribbean mythopoetic art and literature. Furthermore, Ledu's narrative engages with the politics of cultural narratives in a manner that is relevant to Indo-Caribbeans, whose early identity was premised on the retention of Indian values and the virtual exclusion of other cultures and ethnicities. In this light, No Pain functionally criticizes Derek Walcott's call for amnesia as a means of embracing the Caribbean's creative potential, since, as Ledu recognizes, Indo-Caribbeans must critically engage with their own cultural legacy as a means of negotiating their New World Caribbean identities. Thank you.